Open up the House Committee on Human Services today, February 16th, 2011. We have as a possible work session on House Bill 2108. We don't have the fiscal on that, so, oh golly, that's why you're here. Okay, I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 2108, and I'm going to allow invited testimony. Come on up. I would remind you that this bill, I'm so sorry, the purpose of this was to send it over to Judiciary, which will be doing the work on the bill. But come on up. You're here, and I know you've driven a long way to come here. I'm sorry. I would have notified you if I'd realized that you were going to be coming down here.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I'm honored to be able to be here today. My name is Marcus Fant, and I am a juvenile probation officer.
Pull one of them close to you. Don't need to talk right into them. There you go. Good.
Again, my name is Marcus Fant. I'm a juvenile probation officer from Clackamas County Juvenile Department, and I am here on behalf of our department. I wish to speak about our support of Bill 2108. I guess the information that I have comes as somebody who works directly with youth. I am not an administrator. I am not a supervisor, but I work directly with youth. And I will speak briefly about how this bill affects me and my ability to do my job. One of the problems that I see with this, with Oregon law as it stands right now, is that we do not have an aid and assist legislation in the Oregon Juvenile Code. We have one in the Adult Code. This matter is completely blank in ORS 419. And so what happens is that each jurisdiction around the state handles this issue differently. Some jurisdictions borrow from the Adult Code and they use it. Some jurisdictions do not. In Clackamas County, our judge reads this very clearly, that ORS 161 is in the adult statute, and we are not allowed to use that to respond to aid and assist issues. Defense attorneys raise aid and assist issues. Youth are then found to be unable to aid and assist, but we have no ability to come back on those cases and provide restorative services, and cases are simply closed. As a matter of an example, Clackamas County has a case that a youth has 28 referrals to our juvenile department, and the last 19 referrals that have come in, we have simply not been able to deal with. 13 of those referrals have been criminal offenses. 6 of those referrals are status offenses. And these are criminal offenses where people are being victimized, where people are being hit, where police are being called, and local law enforcement is very, very frustrated. And of course, the juvenile department, in our desire to keep the community safe, is unable to respond on these cases. And by being able to provide restorative services, we would then be able to come in, pardon me, as an agency that could then work with this youth and work with the other treatment providers in providing services. One of the other, I believe, misunderstandings about the cost of this bill, and I believe that's why we're delaying today, as we're looking for a fiscal cost, is that there's a belief that this bill simply is going to cost a lot of money. And one of the things that I wanted to say was that this bill, that these cases are costing us money already. This case, for example, this young man continues to involve police time, continues to have new victims, continues to receive services from other agencies. Potentially those agencies are DHS, DD, Developmental Disability Services, and from mental health. The only difference is that when you're working with DD and when you're working with mental health, those are completely voluntary services. And so if a youth or parent does not wish to participate, they don't have to. And without an agency like the Department of Human Services or like the county juvenile departments to be able to step in and to mandate services and to tell a youth or to tell a parent that they have to participate with services, we fail to provide the correct services that a kid needs, and we fail to keep our community safe. And so in order to help protect our citizens in Clackamas County, and we believe that 2108 is actually very important.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fant. I appreciate you coming. And as I said, after we get the fiscal, we're hoping that it will be sent off to Judiciary Committee. We feel like they're better equipped to handle these issues. I know this is an important issue, and these children are being sort of dropped through the cracks in our pavement, and we need to be able to help them. So we will do all that we can, and I will make sure that you're notified when there is a hearing in Judiciary.
Thank you very much.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You for your time.
Thank you for coming. With that, I'm going to close the work session on 2108. As I said, this bill, we're just waiting for the fiscal, and then we'll be sending it over to Judiciary. So with that, I will close the work session on 2108 and open up a public hearing on 2054. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2054 requires an annual on-site inspection and authorizes the delay of the annual health care facility license renewal by the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority until compliance is certified following the on-site inspection. It changes the nursing facility licensing renewal date to coincide with the date of the certification survey, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. You'll also have a dash one amendment to this bill that's been provided to you. The amendment provides some housekeeping language and further clarifies the period of time for the on-site inspections from annually to at least once every 3 years for health care facilities other than long-term care facilities, and it provides additional exception for reissuance of the health care facility license.
Thank you, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. Welcome again.
Thank you. Good morning. Co-Chair Tomei and Gillum, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Strauss. I'm the Interim Administrator of the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care with Seniors and People with Disabilities in the Department of Human Services. You have in front of you our testimony regarding House Bill 2054. House Bill 2054 allows the department to issue annual licenses rather than calendar year licenses. Currently, all licenses expire on December 31st. We'd like to modify that to allow licenses to expire throughout the year to coincide with the annual inspection. The dash one amendments represent unintended consequence as a result.
I'm sorry, we don't have written testimony.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
An email.
Great. I apologize.
That's okay.
I have it.
Is that Connick? The email?
She sent
an
email. Thank you.
Your cuneiform tablet, maybe.
Okay, go ahead.
I apologize.
That's all right.
The dash one amendments represent an unintended consequence to our partners in public health that inspects other health care facilities, not on an annual basis, and so we have submitted the amendments and request consideration of those.
Good.
If you have any questions, I'd be happy
sure.
to answer them.
Any questions regarding the dash one amendments? All right. Thank you very much, Julie. And I think there is nobody else here that signed up to speak on this bill. Anyone interested? Seeing not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2054. Open up the public hearing on House Bill 2065.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2065 modifies the provisions relating to the regulation of licensed professional counselors and marriage and family therapists by clarifying who must be licensed to provide professional counseling and marriage and family therapy services. It limits the use of titles professional counselor and marriage and family therapist to only those who are licensed, and it eliminates the license exemption for counselors and therapists who do not meet the education requirements for licensure.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And we have two people scheduled to speak, Larry Connor and Becky Eklund.
Becky said that she's the board administrator. She had some kind of meeting, and I assume she's going to be here, but I will.
She's in Ways and Means, and as soon as testifying, and as soon as that's done, she was planning on coming over to testify.
Thank you, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor from Portland, and I'm appearing before you as the president of the of COPAC, the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations for Counseling and Therapy, which is a consortium of three professional associations, the Oregon Counseling Association, the Oregon Mental Health Counselors Association, and the Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. I was also one of the authors of the Practice Act that you passed with your support. We passed in 2009, which I am eternally grateful. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 2065, which amends some of the language of that amendment in the 2009. When we wrote the definitions of professional counseling and marriage and family therapy that is now in current statute, we sought to give the legislature a what we thought would be a helpful tool, a very clear definition of who needs to be licensed and who doesn't. And we focused on two issues. First one was licensees diagnosed in treatmental disorders. And therefore, the second part of it was we wanted to define the education and training that was necessary to support that. And we thought that dual approach would give you a clearer sense of who needs to be licensed. What we did not realize, and the board has discovered, that we accidentally opened a door for persons who did not have, because of the language, persons who did not have training, did not have master's degrees, and were not licensed could still diagnose and treat mental disorders. And what happened for the board is they were unable to give consumers as much protection as they wished. So this is an attempt, this is the board's bill. I'm speaking ahead of Becky, and I hope that I'm not misspeaking, but this is the board's bill, but it's an attempt to say, to define that licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists are defined by the fact that their practice diagnoses and treats mental disorders as a substantial part of their practice, and anybody who does that has to be licensed and have board oversight. And therefore, that improves consumer protection, that somebody's not out there saying, I treat depression or post-traumatic stress disorder or a psychotic disorder without any board oversight. So this bill does rectify that in Section 4 of the bill. This House Bill 2065 also takes care of a problem that we, an issue that we did not finish in 2009, which is that we wished to protect the titles professional counseling and marriage and family therapy alongside of licensed professional counselor and licensed marriage and family therapist. As you may recall, I'm sure Chair Tomei remembers this, we had about a boatload of amendments before you even got a chance to read the bill. We were having language problems. And in the rush to get all those amendments done, we neglected to get back and do what this bill does, which is to protect those titles. The reason that the title protection is important is that nationwide, professional counseling and marriage and family therapy are professions. In the case of the states that license marriage and family therapy, that is the title, marriage and family therapist. And their national organization is the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy. In the case of professional counseling, there are two titles that are evenly split between the states, either professional counseling or mental health counseling, which is this title that's used in the state of Washington. In Section 4 of this bill, it allows alternative providers to use the terms counseling and therapy. Because one of the issues we had with the bill in 2009 is we didn't want to put people out of business, but we did want to define our professions very clearly for your sake so that you know who needs to be licensed and who doesn't, and our board's sake that they, so they can offer consumer protection to consumers. But those titles are titles, and there are people that do advertise themselves as professional counselors who are not licensed, or marriage and family therapists. They can call themselves counselors. They can call themselves marriage and family counselors, but we do not want them to be able to say they're marriage and family therapists or that they are professional counselors. So this bill is a way of creating a tighter sense of consumer protection for Oregon consumers. Because Becky's not here, I can say one other thing about the bill. You'll notice that rehabilitation counselors are mentioned there. The reason for that is the rehabilitation counselor requirement of hours is not quite the same nationwide. It's not quite the same as it is for what the board is moving toward, and we were concerned that rehabilitation counselors might lose their ability to be licensed unless they were exempt while working in an agency. So that's the reason that that is there.
Can you tell us what page that is on, please?
It's in black print.
Oh, I see it on page 4. I see. Thank you. Toward the bottom.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, there it is. Line 40 on page 4.
Right. Thank you.
So I urge you to support House Bill 2065 and to pass it on to the House for a vote. And I thank the committee for your ongoing support for all mental health professions and for mental health consumers in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connor. I appreciate your testimony. And I will allow, if Ms. Eklund comes, I will allow her to also testify.
Okay.
Any questions of...
Yes.
Representative.
I am a little curious about why, about the it's page 2, and I believe it's 40 and 45. You've taken out the specific Council for Accreditation of Counseling and Related Educational Programs of the American Counseling Association, and then put accredited by a national accrediting body approved by a board, by the board by rule. Why go from specific to vague?
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, Representative Frederick, as someone who did not write this, I'm not at all certain that I can answer that question. But I do recall some discussion about that when we were writing the bill in 2009, was that there was some sense of not wanting to be too rigid about that in case the accreditation would shift. I can't answer it beyond that. I would not say that I have a clear answer to that question. The board wrote that part of it.
We'll ask Ms. Eklund when she comes.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Appreciate that.
Yes, Representative
Wagner. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, going through this, I understand the difference between therapist and counselor. The therapist can prescribe and things like that. But when we start narrowing this down, and a single board making the decision, you have lots of different types of counseling that's out there.
Correct.
With different religious views and things like that. I, for one, use a lot of Dr. Dobson stuff. I belong to a church that we have a Stevens ministry, that they go and sit and listen to people because lots of times people just need someone to vent with. Mm-hmm. When we start going counselor, professional counselor, what would be the difference? Because to me, a professional counselor is someone who's getting paid for it. A counselor would be somebody who's just there to listen. So like a school counselor is just limited to a counselor, professional counselor. And I'm just wondering if we're blurring the lines a little bit there, putting it to one group of people to decide, and we're going to say, well, we're not going to credit them because of their religious beliefs or something like that, or what they're teaching we don't think is right. Yet it's something they're doing for counseling, and I don't want to harm anybody because of their religious views and the way they are doing their treatment process. Because me as a consumer, I want to go to a Christian counselor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go to a secular counselor. Mm-hmm. If I was of some other religion, I might want to go to a counselor that is specific to my religion. So I'm worried that we might blur the lines with this a little bit on that. I'd like to hear your feelings on that.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and Representative Widener, is that
yes, okay. Correct.
That's a really good question, because that is the complexity of the word counseling. Counseling covers a whole gamut of things. And so when we wrote the bill in 2009, we were trying to define this is professional counseling, and that means that we diagnose and treat mental disorders and that we can receive third-party reimbursement for that. A pastoral counselor in a pastoral setting is exempt from that. They are free, and it's written into the statute that they are exempt from having to be licensed. That is, a school counselor is also, well, they're not exempt by statute, but the assumption there is they're not diagnosing and treating mental disorders. They're sitting down with kids in school and are helping them get their lives in order, and they're helping them get through algebra class and get on to the college and whatnot. That does not define as the crux of what professional counseling is. The bill in 2009 was to say There are social workers and psychologists and nurse practitioners and psychiatrists who are core providers of mental health services in Oregon. And we wanted, because we've been doing this for many years, we wanted licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to be recognized as core providers without limiting the activities of pastoral counselors or Christian counselors or various other rehabilitation counselors. We did not want to limit that. So the term professional counseling means, as it's defined, using mental health strategies to diagnose and treat mental disorders. And in addition, they can do all these other things. But those persons over here that provide counseling, they don't fall under this law. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, it's just one of those, I get nervous when we start doing this without hearing the other side or having somebody else here. How's
right.
this going to affect them and their practice? So lots of times we will do stuff in the
bill. One thing that I can say is when we wrote the bill in 2009, we negotiated with a whole lot of alternative providers. We talked with them, many, many of them. And as a result, we didn't have any people speaking against the bill because we thought we had addressed their concerns. I can't speak to where this bill is with that. This isn't my bill. I'm just speaking in support of it.
Yeah.
And we did have many, many massage therapists, music therapists. We had all kinds of people coming to testify. So it was a very, very difficult bill to pass. We had many amendments. But I feel pretty secure with this, and I think this just makes it a better bill. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. We heard on a different issue, different bill, but it's kind of piqued my interest as we're talking about this, too, the notion of, because it was the bill that we talked about where we were going to waive the background checks for people who are drug alcohol.
Right.
Counselors.
Right.
And that is a group, I think, that is getting some payment for doing that type of work. Are they affected by this, even if they're not? Because that group specifically were folks who, you know, were doing counseling. I didn't get the sense that all of them were licensed counselors. I got the sense that they were folks who'd been through, you know, the hard knock school and working with other patients trying to get them to where they need to be. So having heard the testimony on that bill and applying it to this bill, I'm just kind of curious if this if there is an exemption for those types of counselors who are doing that type of work, who aren't necessarily going to be licensed, but they
got some skills around that.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and Representative Parrish, that's a really good question. They are exempt in current statute. Certified alcohol and drug counselors are not licensed by the state. There's a private board called ACBO, of which I can't tell you exactly what it stands for. That is recognized under the rule of the Human Services Division. I'm speaking out of, I can't say exactly what it is, but they work under rule rather than statute. And we exempted them when we wrote the bill in 2009 that they can practice counseling and professional counseling. They can diagnose and treat mental disorders, obviously addictions, as long as they are working in an agency, state, federal agency. So they are exempt.
But I think,
follow up?
Yes, please. Thank you. But I do think, aren't some of those folks also working for nonprofits, though, doing that same type of work? Isn't there?
They would be exempt. They work in agencies.
Okay. So you
agencies. I'm
agencies.
Sorry if I misled you. All agencies.
Even if they're a nonprofit, not
correct.
A state agency. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you. That helps me a lot.
The difference is that they would not be able to do so if they were in individual private practice.
Gotcha. Thank you very much.
Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I wonder how much of this effort is a protect the consumer versus protect the profession. I mean, if somebody can do the same thing with physical therapists now, for example, who want to own the title physical therapy, but somebody else can be a physiotherapist or something. I mean, in this case, I can be doing something, and I can call myself something that makes me legal. Right, as long as I don't call myself something that you think you are,
mm-hmm.
even though I'm doing the same thing and you're doing the same thing. How does that protect the public? I mean, do you think the public knows the difference between certified, whatever it is,
licensed
professional counselor and mental health counselor, which apparently I can use unless I run against the social work statute that protects clinical social workers. So if I'm a social worker, I can't use a title like that without being licensed. But if I'm not a social worker, I can use any of these titles. So, I mean, I understand the needs of the professions to feel secure in what it is they do, but I'm not sure how this really protects the public since there are so many other titles that can be used.
Right. Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, Representative Greenlick. I certainly understand that that issue. What I can say is that the board tells me that they are repeatedly called by consumers who have been experienced malpractice from someone who is not licensed, but who in their promotional materials say that they do treat depression and they do treat family problems and they do treat schizophrenia or whatever, but what they offer is destructive. And the board has, what they tell me is the board is not able to act then to in any way to respond to that, because those persons are totally outside of their purview. What they want to do, as I understand from the board, what they want to do is they're able to say, if you go out and advertise yourself as dealing with mental disorders, then if you screw up, we can go after you. The second issue that's related to this that I meant to mention during testimony and it slipped my mind is that there is confusion as to, under the current statute that we wrote, an alternative provider or an unlicensed provider would contact our board and say, all right, so I'm diagnosing and treating depression, let's say. Am I okay? And they say, yes, under current statute, you're okay. And then with a matter of weeks, they get a call from the psychologist examiner board and say, you can't do that. And then they call me and they say, I'm totally confused. Your board says one thing and the psychologist board says another. And this particular statute, or this particular bill, would make that definition the same. If you're advertising that you treat post-traumatic stress disorder, then we want you to have board oversight. So to answer your question, is I don't think this bill doesn't really do anything to protect me. What I think it does is it helps the board to say to people, we can discipline you if you're misbehaving.
If I may follow up.
Follow up.
But you pointed out there are two parts to the bill. One is the definition of mental
right.
health, and the other is the title protection.
Right.
I'm asking particularly, how does the okay. title protection protect anybody when, if I can do it, as long as I don't call it what you're called, then, right. then it's okay to do it.
What I would say, Representative Greenlick, is that if someone says professional counseling, I do professional counseling, and the statute defines professional counseling as diagnosing and treating mental disorders, that a consumer might be confused by that. Just like if somebody said, I'm a psychologist, a licensed psychologist, and they're not doing that, that then the consumer says, well, I'm now going to get treated by a licensed psychologist or a clinical psychologist, but I'm not really getting what I'm seeking. We're trying to define that professional counseling is, in its essential nature, is diagnosing and treating mental disorders. And therefore, we would like that term, professional counseling, to mean that. Not counseling, not therapy. Professional counseling and marriage and family therapy. And so...
No, I'm just sort of puzzled by the sense that that would literally protect anybody. I mean, as long as I can call myself a hierarchical counselor, because I have this vision that's come to me that explains to me how to straighten out one's hierarchy, then I can do it. But I can't call myself doing hierarchical counseling. I can't call myself a professional counselor,
right.
even though I might get paid by a client, and therefore
well,
I'm a professional.
When we did write the bill, we had an intent to help you set up a board for alternative providers. If we had our line of demarcation real clear and say, this is what our board does, we're hoping that alternative providers and the legislature in time will be able to set up a board that would monitor and give oversight to them.
I want fewer boards, not more. We have too many boards now. I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Representative.
So, a quick question then, kind of as a little bit of a playoff, Representative Greenlick, but... by changing the title and because, you know,
two parts. One, how do you market this to consumers so that they know there's a change? Because if I need counseling services of any kind, I probably didn't get the memo that we made a change and what that difference is. The other piece of this, though, is if it's limiting this and giving it the title of professional for those particular services, how does that tie in down the road as we kind of continue to make healthcare changes that certainly we're looking at adding mental health and expanding that, especially through kind of federal programs? The ability for folks who offer services to be involved in that system and receive an income from it.
I'm Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and Representative Parrish. I'm not sure I understand the last part of your question.
Well, if we suddenly change, well, not suddenly, but if we change this, if we accept this bill as it is, and now we've said, you know, professional and counselors and marriage family therapists, because we've made a designation in statute, do other providers, as we make changes to health care, suddenly not get paid because they're not recognized as professional?
I would think not, because the third-party reimbursement is limited by statute to certain professions. It's not, for example, go back to your question earlier, if you're a certified alcohol and drug counselor and you're working in an agency, there can be third-party reimbursement for that. There is third-party reimbursement for LPCs and LMFTs and licensed clinical social workers and psychologists, but others, there is no third-party reimbursement that I'm aware of. And in the new system, there would not be, as far as I know. As you know, the system is changing. And
right.
We
don't really just kind of want to be a little forward-thinking. Thank you.
All right.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Oh, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Connor. And I'm sorry that we're ganging up on you because you are the only person in the room. So we'll look forward to Becky Eklund, and I'm glad that the chair will allow her, as the schedule allows, when she comes back in. And, you know, you have experienced the disadvantage of reopening.
Oh, yeah.
Something that you have had all tied up, but your difficulty is compounded by the fact that few of us, I was on the 07 committee, were on the 09, so I apologize, but I need to go back over a couple of things. However, I will give you some encouragement. You have come to a target-rich environment. For the first time in 152 years, the House is even at 30-30. We have co-chairs, we have co-speakers, we have co-co-chairs, and your profession could be of invaluable service. There is a lot of money to be made in this building.
For the dysfunctional family known as a committee.
If you play it right. Help me with two definitions as a layman. You used the word, which I've now lost, treatmental, I think you used that word, it's a new word to me, is that dealing with DSM, and what is DSM again?
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam. DSM is a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. It's the nomenclature that is used by the whole psychiatric and counseling, mental health counseling professions. All codes, anytime I see somebody for depression or anxiety, I have a code that I then submit to an insurance company. That's a DSM.
Follow-up manager.
Uh-huh.
Was it treatmental? Is that a word that... Did I miss?
I'm not aware of what you're referring to.
Maybe you just said treatable disorders.
In my testimony?
Yes.
I might have said lots of things that I don't recall.
Okay.
But it's diagnose and treat mental disorders.
Treatmental.
Right. And mental disorders, as defined, the Section 4 defines that as included in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Okay. One final
follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I suppose a comment that you're welcome to comment on, but I am concerned, and the thing that sparked it was Representative Greenlick's comment. I know you are, too. You're here to serve, and you want to serve folks at various levels that need assistance, but I think there is a confusion that I don't hold you responsible for in your profession. For a consumer who is either just for the first time considering some assistance or even someone who's deeper into therapy, of who's who, mm-hmm. who's licensed, who's what shingle means what. To the extent that this bill can help us, help the consumer understand that, I think it's a good thing. But based on the testimony and the conversation today, that confusion still exists. Or, you know, maybe confusion is too strong, but at least a misunderstanding by the public, an unawareness of who they're calling and what their profession is, what their specialty is, what their ability is to help. You're welcome to comment, but you certainly don't have to.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, I certainly understand that because, as I mentioned earlier to Representative Widener, the word counseling is a mess because it covers a whole lot of territory. That's not necessarily true for psychology or social work. Social work's a little messy. Covers a lot of ground. But counseling covers everything. I mean, lawyers call themselves counselors. So all we were trying to say is there's one subgroup called professional counselors, and it is up to our professional organizations to tell everybody what that is. And we have three professional organizations doing that. Marriage and family therapy actually isn't quite as messy, to their credit. That term has not been as broadly used. Therapy has been, but counseling is wide open. So I certainly understand your confusion about it. What we're just trying to say is these are professional counselors. That's all we're trying to say. And please understand that this particular this proposed statute, I didn't write. So the board has their reasons for wanting to change the current statute, which I did partially write. So I can't always explain the motivation for the changes. I can just tell you what I've been told by the board. I've learned that once you write a piece of legislation and it's passed, it's no longer you have no ownership of that. So I humbly say that's all I can explain.
Thank you, Mr. Connor. Really appreciate that. Oh, one last question.
Well, more of a comment. Maybe this would open the door where we could start suing attorneys for calling themselves professional counselors.
What an interesting idea. Thank you so much. Okay, with that, we're going to close the public hearing on 2065 and open up a public hearing on 217. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2217 includes professional counselors or marriage and family therapists to the list of health practitioners currently defined in Oregon revised statutes, which are exempt from punitive damages if the counselor or therapist was acting within the scope of their practice.
Thank you so much. And we have several people, obviously. Okay, I'll let you two decide who starts.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. I don't know if I need to reintroduce myself
for
the record. My name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor from Portland, and I'm speaking to you as the president of the COPAC, the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations for Counseling and Therapy, which is a consortium of three counseling-related professional organizations. Joining me today is Doug Quirin, who's the ethics chair for the Oregon Counseling Association. He is also an attorney, and he is here in case you ask me a question about some fine point of the law that I cannot answer. But he is not going to testify. He's here to answer questions. He's here to bail me out. Today I'm speaking in favor of House Bill 2217, which is a simple housekeeping measure to add licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to the long list of health professionals, licensed health professionals, who are exempt from punitive damages in lawsuits. And you can see from the bill that the list is quite extensive, including physicians, all the mental health providing groups, physicians, psychologists, social workers, nurse practitioners, and it also includes podiatrists, dental hygienists, denturists, chiropractors, naturopaths, massage therapists, and so on. We, for some reason, are not on this list, and we are simply asking to be added to the list for three reasons. One is we're asking to just have simple consistency. Now that we are considered to be core providers of mental health services, we're trying to make sure that whatever statutes that define or limit or give us responsibilities in statute that are defined for other mental health professional groups are defined the same for us. And so it's just a simple consistency issue. We also are aware that there are a number of persons who hold dual licenses as either licensed professional counselors or licensed marriage and family therapists, and also licensed clinical social workers or licensed psychologists. And we are under the impression that if there ever were to be a lawsuit with punitive damages in it, that a court would find it rather confusing to try to determine how that would be addressed when a person holds dual licenses. And thirdly, and lastly, because this is going to be very quick, the third reason we're requesting this is that our malpractice insurance does not cover defense for punitive damages in lawsuits. So if there were to be a punitive damage, we would have to hire private counsel and pay for that out of pocket, and that is not something that all of the long list of professions has to do. So what we're asking for is to please support House Bill 2217 and pass it on to the Judiciary Committee for a vote there. For simple consistency and fairness. That's all we're asking. And I thank you for getting this bill out so early in the session, because it has a long way to go. And thank you very much. And I'm also, I'm very appreciative of appearing before this committee, because I'm always grateful for the hard work that you do for all of the mental health providers and consumers in Oregon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Connor. Any questions? Yes, Representative Greenleg.
May I ask the counselor a question?
legal counsel.
Has it been tested in court if any of these professions engage in a inside their scope of practice, engage in conduct that would otherwise be awarded punitive damages, that we by statute, even under the separation of powers, can exclude that judgment from happening? Did I make myself clear?
I believe so. Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam and Representative Greenleg, let me see if I can answer that by saying this.
Could you state your name, please?
I'm sorry. I'm Doug Quirin. The current statute has an exception for malicious conduct. Okay? So, and that applies to all of these people who are listed or professions who are listed. So current law allows for punitive damage claims against any of these professions, provided there is evidence of an allegation of maliciousness. Does it currently exist, and are there claims against these professionals on account of an allegation of malicious conduct? The short answer is yes. There are still punitive damage claims.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Harker, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do. I admit to having been left less than perfectly clear after the last discussion about terminology, so I hesitate to raise this. But in this one, where we're adding, in this bill, where we're adding professional counselor, marriage and family therapist, does that accommodate the proposed changes in the previous bill?
Representative Tomei, or Chair Tomei, Chair Gilling, I'm not sure I understand your question, Representative Harker.
I'll try again. The language that is being added in the current bill, the number I just can't see on my screen right now, 2217.
Correct.
Page 1, line 27, is adding professional counselor, marriage and family therapist to the list of protected professions. And what I'm wondering is if those two terms are covered by, included in, excluded by the language under in House Bill 2065.
I just
wouldn't want us to have unintended consequences that went that way.
If I understand it, well, the way that I would read this, it's a professional counselor, marriage and family therapist under ORS 675, and so forth, which means a licensed professional counselor and licensed marriage and family therapist. I don't think that it would have anything to do with the title protection that we're talking about in the other bill. Does that answer your question?
Sure, for now.
Representative Widener.
Just to kind of follow up, and this would probably be for the legal professional counselor. It doesn't say licensed counselor. It says professional. So could a licensed counselor who wouldn't fall into the professional counselor board be open for this? Shouldn't we just have counselor or marriage and family therapist rather than professional?
Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam and Representative Widener, my sense is the answer would be no, because I could make a public policy argument and a public protection argument that exactly what you want is to have this protection available to those people who are being regulated and not available to those people who are unlicensed and not being regulated. So it seems to me that, number one, this provision is consistent with the earlier bill. It is consistent, and they work together. But I would think that the word professional counselor and marriage and family therapist have to be in there in that terminology, a professional counselor. If somebody is not a professional counselor and is not regulated, should they be entitled to a protection and an avoidance of punitive damages? My argument would be no, that you want to encourage licensure, you want to encourage public protection by having the oversight of a regulatory board. So professional counselor, yes.
And I would think that since this bill references 675 on and on and on, mm-hmm. and we can get ledge counsel down here, but that it's described, the profession is, there's a definition of who this is referencing, correct?
Yes, Chair Tomei, that's absolutely correct, right.
Right, and if we need to, we can have ledge counsel come down and help us with this?
Madam Chair, if I may, I think that that's right, so long as the terms used in the current bill are the same terms that are referenced in the other statute.
Right.
And if we're changing those terms,
yeah.
it may not apply.
So maybe what we should do is contact ledge counsel for whomever wrote these two bills, and I would assume it would be the same person. In the meantime, we'll... Was this Representative
I was just trying to clarify this. Wouldn't this be clearer if it says licensed under?
I would think so.
I think that would take away any ambiguity.
I would think so. But we'll get ledge counsel.
So yes, I just want to thank you. I just want to be clear then that if we didn't move on 2065 and we put 2217, since 2065 is a closing the loop, under 2217, the people who you're trying to close the loop for then probably would be covered under this because the term professional counselor would still apply to them. Yes? No?
I'm not sure what your question is. Maybe somebody else's question.
May I respond to the series of questions, please? Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and a number of you. That we have to be a little careful about just license, because this statute also regulates graduate students and interns. So if we just say licensed under, then that would just include me, but it would not include someone who is a registered intern. And when I look at this, bill, all the other references to the other professions just say a denturist under that particular statute or a psychologist under that particular statute. Mm-hmm. And this is a professional counselor or marriage and family therapist under that statute, all of which implies a licensed psychologist, a licensed marriage and family therapist, a licensed podiatrist, and so forth and so on.
Ours says licensee.
Representative Greenlink, you had a...
I'm just pointing out that the medical imaging licensee under...
Right.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Yes. Representative Gilliam.
A quick comment that I did I just referenced that 675.715, and not to go into it, it is pretty extensive, and members, or as you suggest, legislative council might be helpful, but it references that ORS for a reason. I'm not going to make a judgment on it, but there is a pretty extensive explanation of what is considered a counselor under the law.
Thank you. And we did contact Elsie. Yeah. Terrific. Thank you so much. And if you wouldn't mind staying, and we'll, when Ledge Council comes, we'll open this up again. Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to close momentarily the public hearing on House Bill 2217 and open up the works public hearing on HJM 4. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, HJM 4 urges Congress to mandate the limit on mental health care caseloads.
Okay, thank you. Senator Boqvist had some desire to come to testify, but he won't be able to come until after 10, and we will be on the floor at that time. So, unfortunately, we won't be able to hear from him today. And Mr. Mann.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Mann. I am with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I want to start with an apology. You'll notice that your testimony says the House Committee on Health Care. They don't let me out of the Veterans Committees very often, so I mistaken your committee. I apologize for that. I'm also here as the staff for the Legislative Task Force on Women Veterans Health Care. During the interim, that health care task force took a look at all things women veterans, and one of the things that we found was that VA healthcare providers were having caseloads of more than 100 veterans to one counselor. And the task force didn't know if that was a large number or not, but we were hearing from veterans that they couldn't get in to see their mental health. It was taking a month, month and a half, sometimes 2 months to actually get in for an appointment. If you were new to the VA system, your wait was even longer. So as we went around and talked to the women veterans coordinators at the Portland VA Medical Center, the Roseburg VA Medical Center, the White City Dom, the different clinics, what they were telling us was, yeah, 100's a lot. It's a lot for the counselors and to do quality work. It's a lot for the veterans who maybe have severe issues and can't get in as often as they need to. So the next logical question was, well, what is a reasonable number? As we talked to healthcare providers, mental health providers, we talked to a military sexual trauma counselor out of the Eugene Clinic, we talked to the Roseburg, the chief of their mental health, and they all kind of landed around 60. And so the next thing for the task force is, well, what do you do about it? It's the federal government. We really don't have a lot of swing with them. We can talk to our congressional delegation. But last session, when we were working with the governor's task force on Veterans Affairs, we had a lot of success passing memorials out of the legislature and working then with the congressional delegation to move those through Congress to bring light to the issue. In sessions past, maybe you've passed memorials that were, we used to joke, there were letters to Santa Claus. Just really didn't have much juice behind them. But if you coordinate with the delegation as you're doing the work, it turns out that they are excited about these issues. As a matter of fact, I am meeting tomorrow with Senator Wyden's staff on these very issues to determine which ones he actually wants to take, because the delegation is excited about taking these and moving them forward. So HGM 4 is a simple little bill. It says that we urge Congress to cap VA mental health counselors at 60 veterans per counselor. What this would do is two things. One, it would allow veteran counselors, these VA counselors, a little bit more time to deal with their clients. Instead of seeing someone once a month, once every 2 months, they could see them more often and probably provide a better quality of care. For the veteran, it would allow not only the veterans currently seeing mental health, but all those veterans that want to see mental health more access. And the reason why is the second point. If you do this, they're going to have to hire more counselors. I'm not going to kind of sugarcoat this. This is kind of a crude instrument, but it's meant to make VA hire more counselors to meet the demand. In Oregon, we've had 29,000 Oregonians serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to the VA and RAND Corporation, 20% are going to come back with some level of post-traumatic stress disorder. But that number is a little deceiving, because those are only the ones that self-identify having symptomology of post-traumatic stress disorder. There is a large number of veterans that are suffering in silence that need mental health. Now, that 29,000 number is just those veterans from Iraq, Afghanistan. That's not counting the ones from the Gulf War or Vietnam, which we know are large, large numbers that were never taken care of when they came home. So if I were to just put a number roughly and just pull a number on that 29,000, say 20% of them, about 5,000 veterans need mental health in the state, that's a big number for VA to try to manage. And they simply don't have the capacity to do so. And so what we're trying to do with HGM4 is get our congressional delegation to bring to light that the VA needs to do more in the mental health arena for these veterans coming back who need help with their post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, and other issues. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. Any questions here? Oh, Representative Wyden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Tom, thanks for being here. Miss being in veterans with you. And
I miss you too, sir.
I appreciate all the work you guys have done. And I'm honored that you brought this forward, because with having a son in the military who's suffering from PTSD and he's just coming back again from his third trip overseas, I'm glad we're going to be bringing attention to this and shed some light on it. So whether or not it gets any legs or not, we'll find out because of the budget crisis that we all know we're facing. But I'm very proud that you brought this to us today.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Strethery.
Let me echo what, thank you very much, Chair, Co-Chair. Thank you. I want to echo what Representative Wyder said as well. I am curious about the numbers involved, the total numbers, and more importantly, the breakdown in terms of the age of the veterans or the conflicts that they served in. I don't know whether you have that, but I'd be curious to have a sense of that, and if, you know, just to get a sense of what they're dealing with in White City versus what they're dealing with in Roseburg or here in Portland.
Co-chairs, co-vice chair Frederick, I can tell you this: we have in the Oregon, where National Guard is primarily our deployments, we've had 13,000 individual deployments in the National Guard. And that age group is very interesting. It's 19 to about 45 because the National Guard has older soldiers.
Sure.
So if you take 20%, it's hard to demographically separate them out by age group, because you're going to have some of the younger vets and some of the older vets. In our office, where we do veterans benefit counseling and we see these folks to get them into the system, we're seeing all ages. What is fascinating, though, and you'll see in my testimony, when the war in Afghanistan kicked off after the terrorist attacks and then the wars in Iraq, it was the Vietnam veterans that were coming to see us, because they all were triggered from what they were seeing on TV and their post-traumatic stress. So you're talking an age group of late 50s to mid-60s in that Vietnam age group.
Well,
follow up.
That is exactly why I'm asking. They are the ones, they're my friends, my colleagues, who suddenly were affected by this and wanted to talk about the situation. And
absolutely.
I just was curious about what those numbers looked like, especially for those Vietnam vets.
Yeah. I'll get back to you on the actual number that
we've
seen.
I'd like that if you would
work on that.
Thank you.
And if you'd send it to staff,
absolutely,
all of us
I will.
Will receive that. Thank you. Mine's just more comment. Bringing the personal experience into this of dealing with, soldiers and families, this isn't also just about veterans. It's about their families and their children. My son was in counseling the entire time. My husband was in Iraq last year. And the minute Dad came home, the light switch flipped back on. But that year was miserable. So this is also then extending to an additional population when you're talking about, I'm a wife with three kids. Now you've just doubled and tripled how many people we're talking about as it relates to these conflicts that need this type of support. So I just want to...
Co-chairs, Representative Paris, I'll tell you, too, when we look at veterans, 340,000 veterans in the state, when you start adding families and who they touch and care they need, you're talking a million people in Oregon, a third of our population, are in some way connected to our military.
Thank you so much. Any further questions? Representative Billion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here. And I want to do a quick housekeeping thing for me. And I think I know the answer to this. I'm very concerned about brain injury and what's happening, but from kids not wearing helmets, sports injuries. But the biggest growing number of brain injuries are veterans. We're discovering how important that is to this whole thing. I just want to be sure you are in communication, continuing communication, with an organization that I'm a fan of, and that's the Brain Injury Association of Oregon.
Co-chairs and Co-chair Gilliam, yes, we do a lot of work. Actually, we speak at their conferences on that very issue. And I might say that the reason that the veterans are having so much traumatic brain injury is they are living through blasts that in Vietnam and previous conflicts they would not have due to their Kevlar.
Yeah.
And so they're seeing multiple IED concussive episodes. So instead of having just one incident that severely damaged you, you are living through four, five, six different blast episodes because of the equipment, but it's rattling your brain, and you're having the symptomology afterwards when you get home anywhere from mild to severe. And so we very much work with those folks at the Brain Injury Association.
That's very good news. One follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we do these, and I'm all for it. I just want to ask you, from your perspective, you don't have to name names if you don't want to, but when we urge Congress... In our delegation, my first question would be, in our delegation, who are our heroes there or particularly receptive folks that we could underline this to? We can go up and vote on it, but how can we as a committee, as members, and as a legislature underline this? And the same question for the national leaders at the congressional level.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, let me share what I do. When these ideas come up, we get together with the delegation. You'll be surprised to know that the veteran advocates in each of the offices, all seven of them work together, and they meet. And they meet over these bills. And what they do is they divvy up who's taking what. One of our great champions has been Senator Wyden. His office is extremely proactive, has dropped legislation for us and pushed it. It's not enough just to drop it. You got to push it. Congressman Blumenauer has done some things on the home loan and the homeless issue. We've had great luck with Merkley's office on a couple other issues. And as this whole task force idea evolved and there was a consistent veteran program that was interconnected, they saw how pushing those bills was important instead of just kind of letting them come from Oregon. But primarily the key is meeting with them. Now, what's very interesting for us from just a political standpoint, is Congressman Walden. He is now in a position in the Republicans in the House where he can do more than he could have before. And we all work very closely together, and I work on their constituent work for them as well. So I would tell you the entire delegation's involved, and it all depends on which issue fits into their lane. And so this session, I think I have seven or eight memorials, and this is what those meetings are tomorrow and the next days, is to decide who wants to take what, and we start the ball rolling.
Good. Thank you.
Good. Representative. I will just echo. I think Senator Wyden has been one of the strongest champions in our delegation for veterans and veterans affairs. 2 years ago, I sat on a panel with him about reentry and what that means and how do you bring folks home and how do you deal with the family and what services are we providing. And he was pushing the soft landing program and how you reintegrate these folks from mortars and shells and ugly stuff that they're seeing and bring them home safely. And I've always, every time I see him mention how important I think that work is and that he sticks with it and he's done a really great job for Oregon veterans. So I do appreciate that.
They all care. And that's the key. They all care. Veterans is the great unifying issue.
Bipartisan. Indeed. Any further questions? Thank you, Representative. All right. Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the public hearing on HGM 4. And I think we have Melissa James here, and I will open up the public hearing again on 2065, and I'm also going to open up on 2217. Thank you for coming.
Sure, no problem.
So we had some questions regarding those two bills, and help me, colleagues, I think the first question was on 2217. Representative, do you want to help state that again about...
I'll try to drag my brain back in.
Great, thank you. It was on the first page of the bill, line 27.
One sec.
It was adding...
Yes, here we go.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming. 2217 adds the defined terms of professional counselor or marriage and family therapist to the list of professions excluded from punitive damages, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
The bill that we heard right before that, which I think was 2065, is that correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. one of its parts was relating to terminology around licensed professional counselors, etc. And all I was looking to do was establish that if 2065 should pass and the changes be made, that that would not in any way conflict with the terminology referenced in 2217.
No, Chair Tomei, Representative Harker, no, it shouldn't.
Could you state your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Marisa James from Legislative Council.
Thank you.
Whatever ends up being, whatever changes are made by House Bill 2065, you would still have to be licensed as a professional counselor or a marriage and family therapist, marriage and family therapist, to qualify for this limitation in 2217. So you're going to need to be licensed as one of those things under this series 675715 to 675835.
Further questions? Are you not convinced?
I'm fine. No, I'm fine. I take her at her word. And if everyone else is fine, then...
Any other... I know, Representative.
Yes, hello there. I'm not sure whether you are the one who can answer this or not. I noticed that instead of being specific regarding... This is on 2065. Instead of being specific about the counselor accreditation of counseling and related educational programs of the American Counseling Association, that the approval had to come through them, it seemed to go to a much more vague discussion. And someone mentioned gave some examples of why that might be the case, that there was a need to have a little more flexibility. Is that where that was going?
Chair Tomei, Representative Frederick, I'm not sure why this happened here, but in general, if I drafted a new bill, I would do it this way because we don't like to put the name of a private organization in statute because those things change all the time and then the statute becomes obsolete. So if I draft a new statute, I always do it this way.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Any further questions for this witness? Could you stick around because we're going to keep this open for a few minutes and we have a couple of other people who would like to speak.
Sure.
Thank you so much. Becky Ackland and also Stanford Seifer. Okay, if you would come on up also, that would be great. So I think some of the committee had questions, but go ahead and make your presentation and we'll open up to questions.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Becky Ecklin. I'm the director of the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists, and I apologize for not being here earlier. I was next door testifying on the agency's budget. So I also wasn't able to hear the other testimony and questions related to House Bill 65, but I'm here to speak in support. It's an agency bill, and the primary purpose is to strengthen consumer protection. It clarifies who must be licensed, and it removes an exemption from licensure that currently says, if you don't meet the education requirements for licensure, you can still practice and you don't have to be licensed.
But if you want to be licensed, you will have that educational requirement. Am I correct in assuming that?
Chair Tomei, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if you have questions about the specific sections of the bill. If you'd like, I could just go quickly through each section and talk a little bit about the proposed changes. I think the primary issues are contained in Section 4, but in Section 1, it revises the definitions of marriage and family therapy and also professional counselors, and it adds a definition of clinical experience, and that was in there because the board wanted to make sure that people who are working toward licensure are gaining actual counseling face-to-face with client experience as opposed to, say, having an administrative position where they don't actually get counseling experience. And you just talked a little bit about the accreditation bodies, and Marissa's response is exactly why the board was proposing to do that. The section 2 also adds a phrase to the licensing for marriage and family therapists. We already have that equivalent language for professional counselors and hope to be consistent and add that an equivalent or the equivalent as for the marriage and family therapy license as well. And section 3, it changes the term work experience to clinical experience consistent with the change in definition. Now, section 4 proposes to prohibit the use of the titles professional counselor and marriage and family therapist. Currently, the prohibition is on using the title licensed professional counselor, licensed marriage and family therapist. I think that when people go to visit a counselor or therapist, they make some assumptions about whether that person has the education and experience level to provide very good services. Sometimes that's true, sometimes that's not. And so this is proposing to, again, focus on increased consumer protection to make sure that people understand. I mean, they're perfectly able to go to someone as long as they know and understand whether or not that person has met standards set for licensure or not. Now, the protection of these titles still leaves it open for people who want to call themselves counselors. People can still call themselves therapists. It doesn't protect those titles, so we're not trying to put people out of business. We know that there are many professions out there who are not professional counselors or marriage and family therapists, and we want them to be able to continue to provide their services to their clients. For example, art therapists or dance therapists and many other fields. We added the term rehabilitation in Section 4, so when it talks about exemptions for public agencies that provide health and mental health services, we also wanted to provide that exemption for people who are providing rehabilitation services. There's actual national accreditation for rehabilitation counselors, and we wanted to include them in this license exemption. Again, Section 4 eliminates that license exemption. What this sets up for us, the current exemption says if you don't have the education, you can still practice and you don't have to be licensed. For me, what that looks like is you can have a high school student who's out, it's a far reaching, but a high school student who's out providing professional counseling and marriage and family therapy doesn't have to be licensed. There are no restrictions. If things go awry with that person, the consumer has no place to call and make a complaint. There's not really anybody at a governing or regulatory level to respond to those complaints. So right now, somebody who has a master's degree in counseling has to be licensed, but somebody who's a high school student doesn't have to be, but they can provide the same services. The other distinction between people providing therapy is also in Section 4, where it talks about counselors or therapists. People can practice, say, as an art therapist. They can call themselves a therapist, but they should not be assessing or diagnosing or treating mental health disorders. So the distinction is, I think, the mental health disorders based on the, we call the diagnostic manual, DSM. I don't remember what that stands for. Counselors and therapists can still provide the treatment they've been, but this would say we don't think you should be diagnosing and treating mental health disorders. So an art therapist, many of whom qualify for licensure and have had that training. Music therapist, the services they provide are therapeutic. They may not be therapy for mental health disorders. And that's the distinction we're trying to make with this proposed change. Mm. Let me see. I know in previous sessions these issues have been under discussion, and there have been people who disagreed with the changes that have been under discussions. And in anticipation of that, I have communicated with several of those associations, representatives from there, to see what kind of concerns, questions they had about our proposed changes. I think maybe you heard earlier from the Oregon Counseling Association, the Oregon Mental Health Counselors Association. And I also talked with representatives of the Oregon Psychological Association, dance therapists, art therapists, play therapists, to make sure they were comfortable with this, that they didn't have any, that they didn't have concerns, and to answer questions about what does this mean for me? Will I still be able to practice? And I had questions about that, but not concerned about moving this language forward. I contacted two national associations of state regulatory boards, one that the boards that license professional counselors and the boards that license marriage and family therapists. Oregon is the only state in the country that allows unlicensed practice of professional counseling in marriage and family therapy, which I thought was very interesting. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions at this point?
I have a quick one.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. We were well served by Larry Connor before you, but I think he's very happy to have you here as well.
Thank you, Larry.
just a quick comment on this list before I ask you a question. In the legislature, we actually consider, she's not licensed, but we consider Chair Tomei our art therapist. And I've never heard of, is it pronounced Hakami?
Correct.
I just saw a little blurb here from Representative Frederick. Do you want to say anything about that one, or is that just pretty self-explanatory to everybody but me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Representative Gillum, I'm not sure it's self-explanatory, and I'm not sure, actually, that I could explain it very accurately.
Okay, that's
fair. It's a mind-body whole approach.
That was more helpful than what he showed me. So I appreciate it. Here's my question, and we sort of went over this a little bit with Mr. Connor, but I wanted to kind of go back there again. Public perception, consumer difficulty in understanding who's who. You said something about this, but do you feel like this is going to help us with consumer assumptions? I would call it at a street level. I'm not saying that's your responsibility, but I think it is something we're concerned about.
Representative Gillum, I think it would help that. I think that most people do not understand the intricacies and the differences between a licensed marriage and family therapist and a marriage and family therapist. And certainly people will still have the choice to go to whomever they want, but I think it's very important for consumers to have that choice, and if they're going to see someone, they need to know whether that person has had a certain level of training and experience. Not that others, I mean, there are some very good counselors and therapists who aren't licensed, who don't, but in terms of letting people know, I think people make those assumptions and don't do research to find out even, you know, what are those initials after this person's name? You know, when it says MA, should I assume that person has a license, has met some standard, has to abide by a code of ethics, and if I have a complaint about this person, I have some place to go, which is not true.
Thank
you. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Were you here when we had the testimony from the Marriage and Family Therapist? Did we start at 07 or 09?
I think it was 09.
Okay, because we have hours and hours of testimony of terrible stories that people told of seeing counselors or therapists that they assumed had some background and training and who didn't, and many people were really harmed. So we heard horrible stories. So we're actually pleased that this, well, I should have said previous committee was very pleased that this legislation moved forward. Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, ma'am. There are two parts of the bill. The first part that clarifies the field, sweeps everybody in who diagnoses a mental health that's not already swept in. So I suppose you get everybody else after the doctors and the nurses and the social workers. And now you're saying anybody else who diagnoses mental illness, they're ours, and they can't practice except under our title. I think that's what the first part is saying, and I understand that. Well, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with it. The second part is this title protection thing. Could you be a little clearer on how, whether it's protecting the profession or protecting consumers, since I can, as long as I don't call myself a licensed family and marriage counselor or something like that, I can keep doing what I'm doing. And I'm not sure how this really protects the public, because I can advertise myself as some kind of therapist and just not that kind. And then I can do the terrible things that you heard and you don't have any control over. So what have you done here? I mean, what have you hoped to do?
Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Greenlink. First of all, I want to respond to your comment about you sweep everybody else. They're all yours.
I thought you might not notice that.
I noticed that. And, I know you were being facetious, right?
I'm being semi-serious.
Okay. There are still a lot of exemptions in the law that we're not proposing to change. People who work for public agencies aren't required. Clergy aren't required to be licensed. Certified alcohol and drug treatment providers are not required to be licensed. So there are still a lot of people who are out there able to practice. Health or mental health providers in schools don't have to be licensed with us. People who work for agencies that are certified by government agencies don't have to get licensed either. So there's still a lot of places. And I think it would be very radical and controversial of us to propose that all of those people should be licensed. And so we saw this, honestly, as a step, as an additional step, to begin to strengthen consumer protection.
Which is
I'm sorry.
The first part of my question.
Follow up, Representative?
I asked two questions. I mean, I made a statement, and in fact, let me clarify that statement. Before you passed the bill in the last session, there were people who could diagnose and treat mental illness who weren't licensed by anybody. The last bill took everybody else except these exceptions who you could claim were diagnosing and treating mental illness into your fold. And I mean, you swept everybody else except the exceptions. And I'm not questioning that. What I am questioning is, having done that, you now want to create title protection under the assumption that it somehow protects the consumer, even though I can do whatever bad things I'm doing, as long as I don't call myself licensed family and child therapist or something. So I'm not sure how protecting the title does anything except protect the profession. I don't see how it protects the public.
Chair Tomei, Representative Greenlink. I think that it takes a step in the direction of increasing consumer protection, because then people have an idea of the qualifications of the people they're seeing. It also narrows that focus, and I think that, people who are not assessing or diagnosing or treating mental health disorders, their level or the possibility of harm to their clients is less than those who are assessing or treating or diagnosing mental health disorders. So I see that as helping with that level of protection. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Thank you.
Representative Perry.
Thank you. My experience with counselors, and you're right, I don't check their initials at the bottom. I don't know what those mean. I just assume if they've got a counselor on their door, they're a counselor. The distinction here for me, though, is that, you know, when we've had, and this has been with my children, when we've had the need then to kind of progress to a next step, if you will, a next step being like meds, neither licensed nor unlicensed in this scenario are prescribers. Is that correct?
Correct.
And this is a follow-up second piece of that question, thank you, would be my counselor, and like I said, I couldn't tell you because I didn't check, and I don't know that people really will check that, but when we needed that next step, then referred me out to my pediatrician. And my pediatrician then at that point did her due diligence on, you know, based on a recommendation, and there was follow-up involved and engagement before we got to that next step of therapy, that there was somebody there who essentially, you know, was that voice of licensure, if you will, and doing that work with our family to make sure that we were walking in the right direction with our child. So for me, you know, I there might be some strange therapies, and you certainly hear about counselors, I don't know if that's the appropriate term, who've maybe smothered a kid in therapy or some of these horror stories that you're talking about, and they could be done by either group. For me, I guess the hang-up here is the meds, is that if that's the treatment for mental illness, and most mental illness patients really do tend to go to a med, that's going to come from a prescriber who's going to then be engaged in that conversation as part of it. Do you have any sense of if that's not happening? Or
Chair Tomei, Representative Parrish, I think the difference is if someone is licensed, we know that they can diagnose whatever that situation is and know that it would be appropriate to refer to someone else who could prescribe medicine. If the person is unlicensed, we don't know if they have that level of training where they can assess or diagnose or treat whatever those disorders are, or be knowledgeable enough to know this is, you know, this needs to go to a next level. It's not within my level of training, and this person needs to be referred to a psychiatrist or whomever that has the authority to take the medication step or other treatment.
Any further questions? Could just, I'm sorry, Representative Harker, I did see your hand up there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not my realm, okay? But there have been several statements that all reference MHD, mental health disorders. And one example was our therapists may treat certain things with their therapy, but they may not treat mental health disorders. My question is, where's the definition of mental health disorders, and is it clear in the minds of people when someone progresses from mild, moderate, severe agitation to mental health disorders? And how would one know that they are suddenly, perhaps not suddenly, not qualified in the eyes of the board and statute to treat someone that they have been working with?
Chair Tomei, Representative Harker, I think the distinction about, I mean, how you define a mental health disorder is in the diagnostic manual that's accepted nationally. Yes. If it fits within one of those categories, and I'm not, actually this is not my field either, but
If the definition does exist, that's sufficient for me.
Okay.
I don't need to know the definition. Like I said, it's not my realm, and I don't want to waste anyone's time or the committee's time, but it's just apparent to me that we keep referencing this a line that gets crossed.
I think we have somebody who's come up who maybe can help us here. Could you identify yourself again, please?
My name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor from Portland. Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, Representative Harker. We are trained to do that very thing. What is a serious disorder? What is not? As I was listening to you today, I wanted to give you a scenario. When I was talking to alternative providers 2 years ago about the first bill, I met a music therapist. Well, she couldn't really describe exactly what she did in terms of title, but she would treat people who were upset using a didgeridoo, which is an Australian. It was an incredibly moving experience to watch her. She would figure out where the tension was in the person's body, and then she would blow the didgeridoo at that point, and it was very relaxing, and I found it quite moving. Now, if the person came to her and said, I'm hearing voices, and I think I need to kill somebody, and she treated somebody with a didgeridoo, and the person went out and killed somebody, we would have a real problem. And I think the point that Becky's getting at is there would be nobody, that person could, or that family, surviving family or victim, could go to say, where were you, to give oversight. Whereas if I'm treating someone who says, I hear voices and I'm thinking about killing somebody, I have all kinds of training and experience to know exactly what to do. I know whether to refer them to a prescriber, I know whether to get them in the hospital. That I'm trained to do that. And if I screw it up, then Becky gets to call me, and then I have oversight. So we are very well trained using the DSM and using our diagnostic skills to figure out who really has a serious mental illness and who needs to be treated. I hope that puts your mind at rest.
And I think it's important too to recognize you have the title licensed professional family counselor or marriage counselor, marriage therapist, right? I was an MSW, I had a master's in social work. There are a lot of people who can call themselves social workers. I was also a licensed clinical social worker. So I had to go through the kind of training and experience, clinical experience, so that I could call myself that. So if the representative took her child to see a social worker, that person might have a high school degree, but she could call herself a social worker. If she were to come to an LCSW, a licensed clinical social worker, she would know that that person was licensed, had the training, and had the experience that went with that. So it's true that we're not going to be able to tell the public, this is who you should be looking for to treat a serious mental illness. But we would hope that at least by passing this kind of legislation, the legislation that we passed 2 years ago, that we are protecting the public in some way, that they know that this person has the education and training. And I know that you are a pharmacist. I suppose that anybody could pour out some pills into a container, but I trust when I go to the pharmacy, if the professional pharmacist knows exactly what medication I'm getting, what it does, and also has a history, because I go to the same pharmacist, of my past pills that I've taken. So you've got.
And if you don't get that, you have recourse to call
right.
a person who is supposed to make sure this all comes together.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah. So I think there is some public benefit in these folks doing what it is that they're doing without saying people can't do didgeridoo therapy or dance therapy or art therapy. They can still do that, but they don't have the kind of protections and the education and experience that these folks are having. Does that sort of summarize what it is? Okay.
I would, Chair Tomei, one other thing. All of us, when we become licensed, we not only have the documented experience, we've also passed the national test.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've got the training and our education, we've got the clinical experience, number of hours that we're supervised. It's all documented, what we learned how to do, and then we pass the test. And then we get licensed. So it's we've demonstrated our clinical skill over time.
Representative, just to further that comment, it's also incumbent on the professions, and I suppose you do that, to point out to the public what a license means. And we, over the years, when I used to work in asthma and allergy, we had all kinds of people who were treating asthma and allergy, but a board-certified allergist is another level of education and expertise, and those people are very careful about advertising the fact that if you want a real allergist, then you want a board-certified one, as opposed to somebody who treats symptoms. And so I think there is a lot that goes into the professional side. I can't speak directly to counseling, but usually the professional organizations are very good about pointing out the value of what those letters mean that their members possess, as opposed to whoever else has jumped into the pool.
Right. Thank you. Any further questions?
Chair, do you mind if I... as a board, we received 59 complaints in 2010, which is nearly double what we received in the last couple of years. And those, about half of them were dismissed, but a good number of them were resulted in discipline being imposed on the licensees. And though those violations of code of ethics range from breaching confidentiality of their clients to having intimate relationships with their clients. Now, that can happen with licensed professional counselors and therapists, and it can happen with unlicensed. The difference there is the clients have a place to go to help ensure that that sort of behavior doesn't continue to happen, and knowing that the harm that was done to those clients won't continue. Whereas with if the counselor therapist is unlicensed, that client has no place to go except to file a civil lawsuit.
Thank you.
Since you brought that up, thank you. That there were 59 that were licensed. Do you keep any kind of statistics on phone calls you get, and you have to say, sorry, that's out of my purview, I can't help you?
Chair Tomei, Representative Parrish, I think we used to keep track of those, but because of workload issues, we don't keep track. We get calls like that. I take some of them. Our part-time investigator, takes some of those calls, and it's very difficult to tell people. We don't have authority over that person. He's not licensed. Well, where can we go? Because this person harmed my child. There's no place.
You're welcome. Any further questions of these two witnesses? Okay, and we have a third gentleman, Stanford Siver. And could you, I said your name, but I need you to say it.
My name is Stanford Siver. Co-Chair Tomei, Gilliam, representatives, I want to apologize in advance for any breach of protocol. Thank you for being here. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
You bet.
I'm in a rather unpopular position and would like to speak against this bill.
Fine.
I have a doctorate in psychology. I am not a licensed clinical psychologist. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I don't work, I don't think, in the same system as the DSM-4, the diagnostics and statistics manual of the American Psychiatric Association. That's a particular framework. And in Oregon, I'm proud to say there's many people working in many different frameworks of how to work with a broad range of human experience. These are people who have trained extensively and have as much professionalism as the licensed clinical psychologists also have. And I think that they also need to be protected. And the consumer's right to have access to these people and different modalities also needs to be protected. Now, in my mind, this bill is a turf war to say we're going to control who gets access, who gets the dollars, who gets the clients.
Can I just pause real quick? Because as I understand, we have two hearings, and he's referencing this bill, so I just want to make sure I understand which bill he's talking about.
Who's in 6-5?
We have two hearings open. So one was on the malpractice, the punitive damage piece, and one's on the language of the...
Right. Thank you, Representative Parrish. So you were referencing 2065. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's correct. And I've also received an administrative complaint from the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners. not based on a consumer complaint, but based on their part-time researcher noticing that I had the word psychology in my website. So apparently their position, not apparently, their stated position is that I can't use the word psychology, I can't say I have a doctorate in psychology, I can't even say I'm interested in psychology because I'm not licensed. And I think that that's a grave disservice to people of Oregon. And I think their direction partly the reason the American therapist people had so much interaction around this issue is because they're also receiving letters saying you can't say you're a therapist, and you can't say because you're not licensed, and you can't say you're a psychologist because you're not licensed. So there's a difference between what I'm hearing the policy says and what's actually happening. And then I look at the bill that actually takes that language further, and that scares me. I realize this is a complex issue. It's a complex issue for the field as well. There are psychiatrists who argue that, in a sense, this is a controversial view, that in a sense, in a particular sense, there's no such thing as a mental illness. There's human experience. There's neurological problems, and there's human problems. And it may be that the whole field of psychiatry will go away and be replaced by neurology and psychology. Many psychiatrists obviously disagree with that. Who knows? How do we maintain enough openness for people to work in a broad range of modalities and for consumers to have access to that? It's easy to come up with horror stories about somebody blowing a didgeridoo at somebody who then goes out and kills somebody. I would like to think that somebody who is practicing a form of therapy that I actually know nothing about or never heard of would have enough sense to know this is outside of the realm of what I know how to care for, I don't know how to help this person, and would also refer to other sources of other levels of protection for themselves, for their practice, for their client, for the public. That doesn't only come with licensure. That's also human professionalism throughout the field of caring for humans.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Wyden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad you came forward. I mean, to have a psychologist in here actually is a good thing because it kind of shows the lines, because you got psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, counselors, and there's a lot of different people that are involved. And as individuals, we're very complex. There's different things that work for different people. That's why you have marriage counselors and you have children counselors, and I'm worried that we might be making the box a little small here with this legislation as well. And if it's not a turf battle, like I've heard from a couple other representatives up here, so I'm glad you came forward and gave us your testimony today.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming. With that, I will close the public hearings on 2217 and 2065. You mentioned that Senator Boulquist might come.
He was supposed to come after 10, but
yeah.
I think we're okay. Thank you.
Yes.
I didn't know if you wanted to call his office and see if he would be coming.
I would, because he had a committee hearing, their hearings going on one time, I guess. Okay. Is, yeah. Okay. I think any other business for the good of the order? Yes. Okay.
Let me ask you. I forgot what happened.
Okay, with that, and we will not be having a meeting on Friday. We will be meeting again at 9 on Monday. Is that correct?
Correct.
9 o'clock on Monday. And the times, I'm sorry, Representative, don't go just yet. The times will change as we have floor sessions. We may have to go back to 8 o'clock meetings. Just want to make you aware of that, but we will be notifying you.
Do you mean 8:30? You mean 8?
Well, yes, because floor sessions will eventually start at 8. I mean, at 10. Yeah, so we will have to have our meeting at 8.
You got it
right. Okay, so with that, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services.